So I want to thank you first for this honor and this work, and you were much nicer than last summer when Dax Calabino asked me whether I want to give a talk, and I said, well, I don't really have to give one. And he said, so no, why don't you give a talk about this subject, and gave me a new subject for a new talk, and I have 3 days to prepare. This time I will reuse half of that talk. So the slides are already on the web page, and the talk is there, the second half, and you can just look it up there. But to start, the idea is, what can we do for systemic regulations of fermions, materials, starting from the point of view of lattice models? I'll give a summary of the various methods. Emmanuel will talk on some new quantum Monte Carlo methods for TMFT, and then Philip Werner will show some new results, new applications. To start with a simple lattice model, like a Hubbard model, a DJ model, what can we solve when we want to solve it exactly by exact diagonalization? We get the full spectrum, the wave functions, the dynamics, the excited states and all, but limited to small system. So with exact diagonalization, we simply solve the full Hamiltonian on a lattice, and we can do for Hubbard about n equal 20 sites. For a TJ model, about n equal 36 sites maximum. These are small clusters that gives you the local physics. In 1D, you get reasonable results. In 2D, the clusters are about 4 times 4, 6 times 6, limited. One gets information on pairing in a Hubbard model, TJ model, but not much more. What one can do that goes further is you have the DMRG that works in quasi 1D systems. The MRG is in principle the rational method. It takes the matrix product wave function as an ansatz. That's the matrix product state. But one can prove that in one dimension, the matrix size has to grow only with the small power of the system size in the critical state, or it can be constant in a non-critical state, and one gets an accuracy of about 8 digits, 10 digits, so it's essentially exact. As long as we stay on a 1D system. What one can do for 1D chains is system sizes of 1 times 1,000 sites, so pretty long chains. We can go to ladders. What was done is 2 times 400. One can make them wider, but the wider we make them, the more states we need, the bigger the matrix has to be. The bigger systems were done about 10 times 20 or so for a wide ladder. But when you go to such wide ladders, then it becomes pretty variational. So here I would not trust it so much anymore. So here on the wide ladders, it becomes variation methods, and I'll come back to that a bit later. So can we extend DMRG to two dimensions? Since in 1D it's exact, essentially, and it works pretty well. The basic idea of the matrix product state does not work well in 2D. The problem here is I take my system, I take my 2D system, and I split it up into two halves, the left half and the right half. And the problem is the entanglement across the cut. And I have to model that entanglement well. And to model that well, the entanglement entropy can scale with the size of the cross section. and the number of states I need to model tell that entropy is the exponential of the entropy, because the entropy is the log of the number of states. And so the matrix size I need here, m scaled exponentially with the width of the system. And that's why for the wide ladders and the 2D systems, it doesn't work so well. There have been extensions to 2D. There's the PEPS method by Nastrat and Sirac, and the MERA method by Vidal. PEPS and MERA and variants. These methods are 2D generalizations. Instead of the matrix product state, it's a tensor product state. The accuracy of these methods is currently unknown. It's not overwhelming. Ising models work very well. XY models, the magnetization is wrong by a few percent. Heisenberg models, the magnetization is off by 10%. Fermions.
That's by comparing.
That's by comparing to the quantum Monte Carlo. So let's say for a Heisenberg model, it's worse than spin wave theory. It's not very accurate at the moment, but one might be able to fix it. And for a problem where we don't know the physics, it might give us nice results. It was recently applied to fermions. There's FPEPS and FMERA, standing for fermionic PEPS and fermionic MERA. There were papers by Philip Corbo, Giffre Vidal et al. I mentioned one here, Philip Corbo et al. They have a paper in the archive, 09-04-4151. Yeah.
Are there comparisons with other variational methods like Kurzweiler, Jastrow, backflow?
There have been comparisons for bosons with Kurzweiler, and it's much better. For fermions, not much was done yet. The method is out there, one has to test it. What I know is they are not competitive yet for those models where they looked at it. But these were small systems, few number of states, one has to test it. So the accuracy we don't know yet. If it works, that might solve the 2D problem. But the scaling is hard with the number of states. These codes are complicated, take a lot of your the CPU time. And it's worth looking into, but it's not the solution yet. What else do we have? We have the high temperature series. High temperature series work well at high temperatures. They work down to temperatures equal or larger than the magnetic scale J. So in the coup race down to roughly 1,000 Kelvin or so, but not much below that. Below that, it becomes unreliable for a TJ model. For a Hubbard model, it works down to the Hoppig. For the TJ model, it works lower because the U scale is gone from the model. So there we have methods that work. What when we want to go to the bigger systems or this is accurate simulations, we can try quantum Monte Carlo. When we start with quantum Monte Carlo, when we do quantum Monte Carlo for spins, we can do about 10 to the 7 spins. When we do it for bosons, we can do about 10 to the 6 bosons. When you do it for fermions, there's the sign problem. What does it mean? Typically, when there's a sign problem, you can't even do 10 fermions. who here is not familiar with the sine problem? Should I mention something on the sine problem? Yes, okay. I'll do that. Basically, when we do Monte Carlo for a classical system, I want to sample some thermal average of some quantity A, which is the sum over all the configuration C, the quantity A in the configuration C times the Boltzmann weight, e to the power of minus beta times the energy of the configuration normalized by the partition function. Instead of doing the sum exactly, I pick configuration C with the Boltzmann weight. So I pick some Ci with the probability P of Ci is the Boltzmann weight, Ci divided by C. I pick a small sample randomly, then I say that the expectation value is roughly the average over my sample of the Ci, which is 1 over the number of samples, the sum over the configuration Ci that I sample, the measured quantity in the configuration. That's for classical systems. For quantum systems, I have A is the trace of A times e to the power of minus beta H divided by C. These are matrices. The trick in Monte Carlo now is I use some path integral method or some diagrammatic method to map this to a classical system using some path integral scheme. And then it looks like in classical Monte Carlo, A is some over some configuration of paths, of diagrams, from quantity AC times the weight PC divided by the partition function C. That I can sample if the weights PC are positive. What happens now for fermions? For fermions, when you have paths where two fermions are exchanged along your evolution, then the final state when you close the trace is minus the initial state. So here the weight PC is negative. When it's negative, I can't just sample it because I can't pick it with the probability of minus 1/2. That makes no sense. So what one does then is one does the sampling with respect to the absolute value. So when the PC is negative, we have a sign problem. And the basic problem is we sample now with the absolute value of the weight. And to write this as the sum over the configurations, AC times the sine of the weight times the mod of PC, and I have to normalize it by the weights, and I do the same down here, which is the sum over the configurations of the sine of PC times the mod of PC normalized. Now the basic physical problem is that I sample with respect to the absolute value. So I sample essentially bosons. And they sample the wrong states, and that is not efficient. Mathematically, numerically, we get a concept, a relation problem here. We have many plus ones, many minus ones. We need the average. That is an exponentially small average, and so the errors blow up. Because this down here, this mean sign, is the ratio of the partition functions of my system divided by that where I take the mod of the weights, so by that of bosons. So that's the ratio of C divided by C of some bosonic system where the signs are ignored. And that ratio of partition functions goes like exponential of pay of minus beta times volume times the difference in the free energy densities. So the mean value goes to zero exponentially fast as we increase our system size or lower the temperature, but the errors remain large for the one. And so the pair of samples I need grows exponentially with the system size. And then we soon reach an end. So what can we do in that case? We can go to methods that have no sign problem by doing, for example, variational methods. We can do the variational Monte Carlo methods, like a fixed node approximation, when we assume the sign structure of the wave function, then the sign problem goes away. Or we can invent new Monte Carlo methods that don't suffer from the sign problem. There's one method by Conley and Drummond that is called Gaussian quantum Monte Carlo. A beautiful method, sign problem free for any electronic structure Hamiltonian. It's wonderful, it's great, we tried to use it. We found some problem, we fixed the problems. But what turns out is this method works, but in this method, the central limit theorem breaks down. In order to do the Monte Carlo sampling here, for that to make sense, we need to have a finite variance of the quantities we measure. Because the error on this is the square root of the variance of the quantity A divided by the number of samples. What happens here? We have no sign problem, but the variance of the quantities becomes infinite. So the error is infinite. In weakly correlated systems, it works. When it becomes strongly correlated, boom, it breaks down.
Magnus?
Yes?
Can one characterize more precisely the statistics of these things? I mean, are they power law distributed?
They have power law distributions, yes.
Non-Gaussian.
They have power law distributions. The power law distribution come from the gauge terms we add to get rid of the sign problem.
Right.
And those powers become so small that the variance blows up once the temperature becomes of order J, once it starts to correlate.
And this exponent of the power law is known?
That exponent depends on the temperature, on the couplings, yes. That we have looked at. It blows up once the system becomes a non-Fermi liquid, once there are correlations happening locally.
So the eventual limit distribution is some sort of Levy distribution?
Yeah. That took a while to figure out what goes wrong. After we found it, some people told us, we already knew that happens for bosons. We just hoped it wouldn't appear for fermions.
I'd like to discuss this more.
Yes, we can do that. The next is you can do some approximations that work on a smaller system, that work on a small cluster. You add some of your physics theory intuition. That's what gets you to dynamical mean field theory and cluster schemes. That's what Manuel Gull will talk about next. And finally, we have the new method with Prokofiev and Svistonov called the diagrammatic Monte Carlo. Now that name is a misnomer because they call all the methods diagram C and it's always their newest method. What one means here is to sample the Feynman diagrams for the self-energy. So we sample the diagrams. And essentially, those from electronic structure might know the GW method. The sigma is first this diagram plus more and more and more. We sample those diagrams to 10th order, so instead of just the first one. And the question is, does it actually work and converge? And the surprising answer is, when you use not too big, it actually works. So
what happens when U is big?
When U is big, eating up the diverges, the oscillates more and more. What you can do then is you can take the T-matrix scheme, do ladder diagrams, the packet diagrams, put that into the Monte Carlo. That can in principle be done. It was done for the contact interaction, but not yet for the Hubbard model. These are things that can in principle be done. Whether they work or not is up in the air.
But if you start selecting some random graphs like ladder or parquet, then what's the purpose of just Monte Carlo?
No, it's a partial resummation analytically, and then on top of that, a sampling.
Yeah, I see. You don't select.
But by Monte Carlo, you don't. You want to partially resum things before you sample. That might help with the large U or the sign problem.
It's going to help in some regimes of parameters.
Sometimes it will help.
Others will help at low density.
Yes.
And that.
Yes.
It's not here.
Yeah.
It's a universal recipe.
Yeah. But any analytical trick can be improved by sampling of the diagrams based on that formulation.
What exactly do you sample?
We sample diagrams. Feynman diagrams.
So draw random.
We draw random diagrams. Yes, insert lines, remove them. Insert bubbles, remove them.
Up to a certain order.
Up to a certain order. The sign problem here depends not on the system size, which is infinite. It depends on the order of your diagrams.
They also
exponentially again on the order. Yeah.
So you're doing the integration over the external momentum or whatever with Monte Carlo.
Yes.
I guess.
External, internal, all by Monte Carlo. Yes.
In addition to
order.
Plus the diagrams themselves. I generate them also by
the
Monte Carlo.
Is how quickly the error bars increase with the order.
Exponentially.
Yeah. So you essentially have to truncate at a certain order, like third order, fourth order.
Eighth order.
But
is the truncation
a more complicated model?
It might happen earlier, yes. And you hope that it converges before the errors blow up.
Yeah, so it's a bit like the exact Fermion method.
Yeah.
You hope they converge before.
Yes. Yeah.
With the sign problem. Yes.
But you're not dealing with momentum integration, only with energy integration.
No. I do the momentum integration also by Monte Carlo.
Yeah. And so the eighth order?
Yeah.
It's a huge order.
Sampling in Monte Carlo does not depend on the space, on the dimension of your space.
The base of the diagram and eighth order would be purely number.
I sampled it. I do not evaluate each diagram exactly, but I sample over the space of diagrams at the same time as, for example, the momenta and energies. That's the nice thing in your Monte Carlo. You don't care how big your space is. You just take a sample of a few million representative diagrams, and that gives you an answer. No matter how big your space is. Let's see if we can turn this on. So as examples of what one can do, I want to switch to some results I collected last summer when the talk topic was a bit more specific. It was what is the status of numerical simulations, not of fermions in general, but of superconductivity in the Hubbard model. And that shows kind of what are the limits of the various methods, what can be done. Using ED, we can look at small clusters, and one can clearly see there is pairing in a T-chain model, in a Hubbard model, there's pairing, but we don't know whether the pairs are correlated, whether they are superconducts or not. What I have to say that this talk is impossible to do actually on this topic because there have been thousands of papers. So I'll pick just a few representative examples, some results, and just for one specific model. And I asked some colleagues what they think was the most important calculation on the Hubbard model in the last 20 years. And what should one mention? Richard Scaletta sent a nice slide showing how important it is to take into account the sign problem. because there are rumors every few years that because the sign is not physical, you can ignore it. But they did a calculation for a four-side plaquette in the Hubbard model.
What does that mean, ignore it?
You can just ignore the sign because...
We replace sign P mod P by mod P.
Yes, just drop the sign because it shouldn't be physical.
This is obviously crazy, no?
The sign problem is dependent on your representation. It's basis dependent.
Yeah.
Yes, it's crazy. But here's a clear example. A four-side Hubbard cluster measuring the D-wave pair susceptibility, ignoring the sign and including the sign. And at high temperatures, you can ignore it, of course, because there's no exchange and nothing. At low temperatures, without the sign problem, you will say there's no D-wave pair. With the sign problem, you see there's a pair on a four-side cluster. Variational methods work pretty well. Here's one example of some work by Nantini, Miguel Trivedi's group. They did some Kurzweil projected a D-wave PCS wave function, looked at the doping dependence and found a nice region with a finite D-wave order parameter. So the Hubbard model, variationally, if you look for D-wave pairing, you find it. But it's a very small amplitude of the pairing. And that's the basic problem of the strongly correlated materials. Things happen at low temperatures. The signals might be small. Similar work for the TJ model by Sandro Zorella and his colleagues. They looked at the fixed node here. They got the Carlo simulation of the TJ model and improved it by some Lanczhoff steps which release the nodes a bit and make it more accurate. What one sees is that the D-wave pairing becomes weaker and weaker, smaller and smaller, the more one relaxes the constraints. And the hope is when you extrapolate, you still end up with something finite. And indeed, they see that it could go to something finite. But when one then looks at the pair correlation function to measure directly whether it is here the superconducting or not, oops, I have to go. The surprise is it's very, very weak. It's about of the order 5 times 10 to the minus 3. And here, in addition, they showed the results from the TMRG on a 6x6 cluster, which shows pairing that's also essentially not there. It's about 2 times 10 to the minus 3, but it seems to agree pretty well. And that is surprising, because when you look at them, they looked at the system, which is uniform, homogeneous, no stripes, and they find pairing. Steve White looks at these ladders. He finds strong signature of stripes and no pairing. But when you look at the raw data, it decreases pretty well. On the 6 times 20 ladders, when you do 6 times 20, so when Sandro does 6 times 20, he sees a homogeneous system, no stripes. In this variational method, where you start from a uniform system. Steve White has a 6 times 20 system with the open boundaries, and they induce some stripes. What that means to me is that on the 6 times 20 or 8 times 20 system, the MG becomes pretty variational already, and I wouldn't know whether I want to trust those stripes that are seen there. With the same boundary conditions in both systems, Sandro told me he does not see stripes with his variational method with a very similar energy. So it means to me there are many different states that have similar energy around, stripe phase or no stripes. And that's the problem I see with the variational methods.
Matthias, I guess the thing I'm not completely grasping is, what does it mean, see stripes or not in the simulation? Because at the end of the day, what we are calculating is some correlation function, and what you
on the 6 times 20, you can look at the charge distribution.
Okay.
And Steve writes these clear stripes of holes in the charge system, a clear modulation. Sandro sees no modulations.
Right, so when you are saying that the results, the actual data are pretty close one to the other.
For the, that's for the pairing amplitude, yes.
For the
density, it's, there are big differences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is close to half filling, is that?
That's slightly doped, yes, close to half filling.
Yeah, I think Shi-Wei Zhang found some very large spin waves, and so that, I mean, some of these things could be resolved if there were longer link scales.
Yeah.
So as you, 6 by 20 is probably not big enough. I mean, he went to, I'm not sure, 30 by 100 or something, and he saw some long, much longer wave structures because there's like a spin wave, which the wavelength depends on, the doping.
Yes, that was at the much lower doping. He had still 1/6 doping, so pretty.
Yeah, but it resolve some of these issues if there is a...
Yes. But that means we might need much bigger systems to resolve that issue, right? And the 6x20 system might be too small.
And so if you take a system that has these instabilities and you put it in a smaller lattice, then it's going to do things to try to...
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's more, there's also some work by Shi-Wei Zhang where he looked at the Hubbard model using the constrained path Monte Carlo method and concludes there is no B-wave pairing. He starts both from a trial wave function that has the pairing built-in and one that has no pairing built-in, and the decay is rapid to a very small value that's essentially zero. But if we look closer, what is zero for him is about 5 times 10 to the minus 3. It's the same value that Sandro Zorella finds in his variation work, where he says it superconducts. So not only might we need very big systems, we might need to look at very small amplitude and make sure they're zero or non-zero. And at the raw data level, the amplitudes agree between those papers that claim the Hubbard model is superconducting and those that claim it's not superconducting. When you look at the scheme like the DCA, the results by Thomas Meyer, Mark Scherl, and others show a pair susceptibility that diverges at the temperature scale of about 1/40th of the hopping. This might show there's pairing. What one has to be careful here is they cleverly chose special clusters that frustrate any competing order-like stripes. If they take other clusters, they don't see that. Okay. So here, from that, I would conclude that you can find something from smaller clusters if you put in what physics you want, and if the ground state is really superconducting, then I would say that that choice of cluster is probably the right one, that's the good one, and then you can trust this number.
But does the pairing amplitude agree with the other results you already showed?
They do not calculate pair correlation functions.
It's very simple to measure. There's no reason why not to measure that.
They have not measured that back then, and it's a pretty small cluster still, 26 sites. We need a 10 times 10 cluster and measure it there, for example. Then I think one should compare that. The problem with the pair amplitudes is, I think, that the pairs are just not local pairs, but they are extended. When you look at the local single pair, which is 1/10 of the amplitude only of the full pair, then the correlation function can't be more than 1%, 1/10 squared. So it's a pretty small signal to look at. Now, I will think this will be done. Diagrammatic Monte Carlo, we have not looked at pairing yet. We looked at the energies and densities, plot them here as a function of the diagram order for a U of up to 4. And we find that at order 1, 2, it differs, and then from order 3, 4, 5, it it converges for the energy that is first order, so you have the GW essentially, that is second order, third, fourth, and then it converges pretty rapidly. So this method works for intermediate U. One can compared to your DMFT, the single site works well at a small u of 2, at a large doping, at small doping from half filling and there. But the larger u, the single site result here, are not the same as the Monte Carlo. But in a cluster scheme, it does converge, and from the cluster on, the results are essentially the same. So that shows that the DCA works well there, Gibbs can be trusted. In three dimensions, I don't know yet how big clusters we can do. In 3D, the diagrammatic Monte Carlo works as well. The DCA, we have to figure out without how big cluster one needs to get the same results. Finally, the Gaussian quantum Monte Carlo method. There, the main result is by the Imada. He improved it a bit, pushed it to the limit. He can do a U of about up to 6 and a system size of up to about 10 times 10. And he concludes that the pair correlation function decays just like that of free fermions. There is no pairing signal. But when one looks at the signal, again, as the function of doping here, when he says it is very small, then it's about with the order 5 times 10 to the minus 3, the same signal we saw before. So what I would conclude from this is that things are hard, are tough. The various methods essentially agree with what they give. But to conclude from the numerics of small clusters might be very hard. The high temperature series, here's the results from Priyatko. That works to a temperature of about J. They trust it down to one quarter of J here. In Putica's case, Priyatko et al. Trust it to about J. There's some evidence for D-wave pairing, but it's weak, and one can't go down to the critical temperatures. So to summarize here, there are some things we understand. The attractive Hubbard model, I haven't shown that we understand so pretty well. The repulsive one in 2D, the D-wave pairing is favored. That's where we all agree. There has been a lot of progress in methods. Still, the Hubbard model is an open question. But we have lots of methods that work well for the moderately correlated materials, and that should be applied now. And the methods moved from lattice models to the material, and then we have lots to do here. And with that, I want to pass on to Emmanuel, who will mention some new quantum Monte Carlo methods for the DMFT. Other questions before we switch?
Questions?
Yep.
Have a quick question about the series for the TJ model. Mm-hmm. So if we are close to Hoffelin, you are saying that the series can really be trusted down to temperatures of order J.
Can the height of a system itself the temperature of order change? Yes.
I see. So that means that if one does the same sort of work with it together, comparing the various orders and so on, they agree. We did that for Hubbard in 3D. They agree down to T of order J. Yes. I'm a little bit surprised by that because there's already physics between hopping J.
And the reason is that in the series, when you take the public series to the eighth order, you need about four orders to capture the U scale and then the hopping scale T. When you go to the T-chain model, that U scale is gone. And you can go one scale below the hopping scale, and that's then the J scale.
Anyway, there is only one parameter, right, which is T over J. So
yes.
I guess my question is more a quantitative one. Is that is it T of order J, or is it T of order 10J or 20J? You know, it sounds like a stupid question. But
Bill Puttiger says, so Bill Puttiger says it's 0.1J.
What, sorry?
Bill Puttiger says it is 0.1J. I don't believe that. I think it's order J. It does depend on how you extrapolate the series using the Pades. And if you do the Pades, then it seems it works down to about 0.25J, 0.1J. But I think this is just for the Pades. When you change your summation scheme things differ, so that's why I say it's order J.
Yeah, because you know 0.1J is 200 Kelvin.
0.1J, I don't believe.
So yeah. So that's all, that would be great if that were true.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's down to J.
Yeah, maybe down to 2000 Kelvin.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've heard a lot about numerical methods, and I'm going to focus on one of these improvements of numerical methods, the so-called continuous time quantum Monte Carlo algorithms. And there has been a lot of progress and a lot of work on this in the last couple of years, and by far, well, the smallest part has been done by myself. There are a couple of experts here, Matthias, for example, or Philip in the back. Because this is the first talk that is on that mentions DMFT, I probably have to give a quick introduction to dynamical mean field theory, unless. Oh yeah. Well, even though the two experts are sitting in the audience, I'm then going to quickly introduce these continuous time quantum Monte Carlo methods and show some comparison to previous methods. I'll show the weak coupling methods, an expansion in the interaction, and a hybridization expansion, and a further algorithm that's very good for large clusters. And then before Philip does applications, I'll show some with very limited results myself. Okay, so what we would like to solve are lattice models, the same lattice models that have been mentioned in the last talk, for example, a Hurd model that's written up there. And the idea behind this dynamical mean field theory is that you say that your important physics is essentially local, so you would like to pick one of these sites. And if you go to the limit of infinite coordination number, you can map this exactly onto an impurity local problem that is coupled to a bath and a self-consistency condition that sort of dynamically adjusts the properties of this bath so that you represent the original lattice model. Now in formulas, this impurity problem looks like this here. You have an effective action. That effective action has the hopping effects here with retardation, and you have your on-site interaction, and your self-consistency condition is down here. Now, the hard part numerically is the solution of this impurity model. That's where almost all your CPU time is spent. So starting from some initial guess that comes out of an LDA calculation or some non-interacting density of states from a model calculation, you have to solve this impurity model starting from this Bath Green's function. You obtain some Green's function that you then iterate in this washing machine until you obtain a converged solution from which you then extract the physical properties that you would like to have. For example, using this quantum Monte Carlo methods, using a maximum entropy method to obtain a spectral function. Okay, now there are various improvements to dynamical mean field theory, and one of these improvements is the so-called cluster dynamical mean field theory that I mentioned here because I'm going to show some results later on. That has been developed by Lichtenstein and collaborators, Jarrell and collaborators, and Kotlior and collaborators. The idea is that we have this local method, and we might as well not just look at one impurity, but enlarge this impurity a bit so that we get some momentum structure back into our problem, and thereby maybe are even able to extrapolate to the infinite continuous momentum problem. Now, in the so-called dynamical cluster approximation, or DCA, this momentum dependence is reintroduced by choosing the self-energy not constant everywhere, but constant on patches within the Brillouin zone. And for a four-side cluster that I've drawn up here, these momentum patches look something like this. So here you have four different, you have your self-energy coarse-grained in four different momenta. The impurity problem that you get to solve becomes more and more involved. Now you get the cluster indices for your bath, you get more on-site interaction, and the task numerically becomes much harder. Also, your self-consistency is a bit different. Now, traditionally, one of the successful methods of solving these impurity problems is the Hirsch-Fein quantum Monte Carlo impurity solver. This is a solver that is based on a Trotter decomposition. I'll say more about this later. And it has become sort of the standard unbiased solver. The idea is that you take your Hamiltonian, you write down your partition function as trace of e to the minus beta h, and you split your Hamiltonian into your local part with the interaction and your hopping part, or that can also contain retarded your Bath Green's function. Now, in order to simulate this on the computer, you split this H naught plus V, and you break it up. This here is an approximation. This is not exact. This discretization of this integral up there introduces these Trotter errors, which you can then control by going to larger and larger Ls. For this four operator term, you need an auxiliary field decomposition, and the whole problem ends up being a problem of sampling a configuration on discretized time slices. So we need to sample an expression that contains these discretized time slices. And we need to be careful of the approximation that we have introduced here. Now, breaking up your integration or your integral in this way is just one of the possible ways of solving this. Rubtsov and collaborators have found the so-called continuous time algorithms, where we have a different approach of solving the same partition function without doing any sort of approximation to it. So here we write down the partition function in the interaction representation here. Again, it's split up in a part that we want to do exactly and a part in which we perturb. Then we write down a perturbation series in this. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know if people are aware in this community that these methods were actually used in the 60s with Hanscom and Kalos done these things. They had different Hamiltonians, of course, but that equation would have been the same. I mean, the V would be different. So, I mean, the Hanscom's method developed into something that, like Sandley, I used with stochastic series expansion. And a Michaelis method is developed into what's called Green's function Monte Carlo, and then later into diffusion Monte Carlo. But it's essentially the same idea, I think. Although it was at, both of these were at zero temperature rather than finite temperature.
Yes, well, of course, here when you go to zero temperature here, this series goes up to infinite order, and it's no longer possible to sample it in a stochastic process. Yes. So the important thing here is that there is no approximation whatsoever in this entire process.
Your methods too, yeah.
Okay. Well, if we have a partition function that we can write down like this, then you can see that at zeroth order, well, there's just no interaction vertex. At first order, there is one interaction vertex that's somewhere between zero and beta. We can go to higher and higher expansion, and this series, of course, can be easily sampled on a computer by just sampling all possible orders up to infinite order stochastically. Okay, so there are two complementary approaches to this in the context of these impurity models. One is the weak coupling expansion that's been originally developed by Alexey Rubtsov and collaborators. And the other one is this hybridization expansion that's been developed by people here in the audience. So you see, the different choice is just which part is treated exactly as this H naught and which part is treated as the interaction. So in this weak coupling method, we just expand in the interaction and we treat the hopping part exactly. Whereas in the hybridization expansion, we treat the local part, the local Hamiltonian exactly, and we perturb in the hybridization. And it's very important to note that any analytical diagrammatic expansion can, in principle, be converted into some sort of quantum Monte Carlo algorithm. And it just depends on whether these expansion coefficients have assigned positivity, whether such an algorithm then is efficient or not. And also all these tricks that have been developed in the context of analytical methods, so for example, borderline methods and so on, can in principle be used for these algorithms. So what are the advantages of these continuous time methods? Why does one care about it at all? So there are basically three important points. First of all, we have no approximations. You'll see, I'll show you that this Doppler error comes back to bite you. Then we have the possibility to do much more general interactions because we don't need this auxiliary field decomposition. And here, for example, we can do exchange and pair hopping and thereby access new physics. And finally, what is important when you actually want to do it is that you get a speed up of about a factor of 1,000. Now, the intuitive picture of where the speed up of a factor of 1,000 comes from is that when you do the sampling of your diagrams here on a discretized grid, you need features that are about maybe about the factor of 10 times smaller than your smallest features that you would like to resolve in this method. So therefore, if you can have a continuous method, you gain this factor of 10, and all of these algorithms are basically determinant algorithms with a determinant that scales as the cube. You gain an order n cubed for all these algorithms. Okay. Let me very quickly go through these discretization errors. Here you have a very old plot that is stolen from the review of two of the people in the audience here, where you have a Hirsch-Phi simulation that has a very small L, so very few time slices. If you then go and you increase the number of time slices, you see here is plotted the imaginary part of the self-energy versus Matsubara frequency. If you include some more time slices, you get closer to the exact result. You can go to even more time slices, as you can see. You get closer and closer, but here already you're starting to see the first statistical noise. Whereas now if you do this exactly using one of these continuous time methods, like the CT-aux, you are exactly on top of a curve that has been computed independently by a method that turns out to be very good in this regime. So not having this helps you to avoid extrapolation and extrapolation errors from having to extrapolate to the infinite curve here. The second point is this performance comparison. So the performance gain that you get by switching to these continuous time methods, plotted here is as a function of inverse temperature, the typical matrix size that one has in a problem. Now this is a semicircular density of state with a U of that bandwidth. You should note that the numerical effort on your computer is then the cube of the matrix size that is plotted here. Now for a Hirsch-Phi algorithm, you have to choose the time-slice discretization that you would like to have. And up here is a typical choice of such a discretization. In these continuous time algorithms, you do this partition function expansion, which spends stochastically time at each order as much as these orders contribute to the final integral. And this is related to the term in which you're perturbing, so essentially the potential energy in this case, or the kinetic energy in that case. And you can see that for the weak coupling method in this case, your matrices are much smaller than in the Hirsch-Phi, and for the hybridization method again, your matrices are much smaller. Therefore, these algorithms become extremely more efficient than traditional methods. Of course, this will cause one of these methods perturbs around the non-interacting limit and the other one around the atomic limit. The weak coupling solver here is very good for the non-interacting case, and the hybridization expansion very good for very large interactions. And somewhere in between those two lines cross, which turns out to be here at a U of about 1.5 or so, whereas the typical U in which you are interested in this problem is around 4 or 5, where you can see this kink here in the energy, which is the Mott transition. So that just tells you that these two approaches are in some way complementary, and it depends on the problem that you are looking at, which one might be more efficient to use. Okay. Let me go back to this weak coupling method and just quickly mention what it is about, or how it works. So what we do is we write down this weak coupling partition function. Up here you see there's some overall expansion order, a u to the k over k factorial, and an integral here over all interaction vertices over this sum here that contains some auxiliary spins, a product over spin, and a time-ordered product of these two operator terms. Sorry. We can then rewrite this as a sum over all orders, and here having just a determinant in the back. And of course, on the computer, we know we don't know how to do these time-ordered products, but we know very well how to do matrices or determinants of matrices. And once we have it written in this way, this becomes a very efficient numerical algorithm. So basically, configurations of this integral are given by the locations of interaction vertices that we have up here. And we can sample every single term of the integral up here by just stochastically choosing to insert vertices into such a configuration. So this term has some weight up here. That term has a different weight. And we can go from one term to the other using a Monte Carlo process. Of course, there has to be an inverse update from this to that, which is the vertex removal. And then we can design various other updates that depend on the context, whether they're efficient or not, for example, a vertex shift. And in this way, every single term up here can be sampled stochastically, and we get a result for the partition function or for various observables in this ensemble up here. There's a variant of this, which is the so-called continuous time auxiliary field method that is based on the decoupling of the interaction with an auxiliary field. Here is described how this works. So we have a four operator term, which is decomposed into an exponential of two operator terms. We can then write the partition function as a time-ordered product of such terms. again, we get a diagrammatic expansion. We get diagrams at each order, and we can sample them by inserting or removing these vertices, flipping vertices, shifting vertices, and so on. This complementary approach, the hybridization expansion that expands around the atomic limit, is exactly based on the same expansion. So here we have as the exact part, the local Hamiltonian, and we perturb in the hybridization, which I've denoted HMix here.
What happens in the previous transparency with the phi Hirsch index, the sigma?
Where?
SK, this S1, S up to SK. You sample over those?
Yes, this is a sum over.
Sampling. Okay, space is bigger.
Bigger than where?
Before, because you have to do all the diagrams plus all the phi Hirsch coordinates.
Well, yes, I've just hidden from you that I also need to introduce auxiliary spins here.
So you're sampling the bigger space?
No, I'm sampling exactly the same space. I had to introduce auxiliary spins here because I've not told you that this interaction here is repulsive and you get a horrible sign problem if you don't do that. I have to artificially enlarge the configuration space in this weak coupling method in the case of a repulsive interaction. I can show this on a piece of paper later. Okay, so in the hybridization expansion, our diagrams, our configurations, are either have no operators present or have some hybridization operators present, two, three here. And we can then go and sample all the possible configurations, again, that we have by inserting or removing such hybridization operators. So the processes can be taking such a line of a local electron being present for some time, removing it, shifting an endpoint, inserting an anti-segment or removing one, and so on. You can design an infinite number of moves that sample each possible term of this expansion here. And because the local Hamiltonian is very easy in this case, the interactions are taken into account almost for free, at least in the density case. Now, if you have more complicated interactions than density-density, so for example, on clusters with complicated multi-orbital problems with phonons and so on, then everything here gets much more complicated. I'm not going to go into this. Just in general, your local Hamiltonian becomes a matrix. You don't have to go to a basis that diagonalizes this matrix because you don't want to compute matrix exponentials, and everything becomes a bit more elaborated. So this has been pioneered by Philip Werner and Christian Haule at Rutgers. I'm sure they're going to talk about this at some point. So which algorithm should one choose for which problem? Well, for large cluster calculations, currently the continuous time auxiliary field is the method of choice. It turns out to be very easy to go to large clusters if the temperature is high and the interaction is weak, as the effort it goes like n beta u, where n is the number of cluster sites, and everything cubed. If you have problems with density-density interactions, then the hybridization expansion is extremely efficient because it's essentially linear in the number of orbitals that are considered. Now this is just, yes?
Why would you have problems with density-density interactions?
Why would one have
that? If you have problems with what physical, why would this come about?
For example, a completely rotational invariant Hamiltonian. And finally, if you have problems with more general but weak interactions, then the weak coupling expansion is the method of choice. For problems with general interactions but very few orbitals, the hybridization expansion, again, is the method of choice. And there has been a lot of work on this here. Okay. So before I pass over to Philip, I would just like to mention some very small example. So what can cluster dynamical mean field theory do with these algorithms? Well, we have the Hubbert model here. We look not at the single impurity on this 2D square lattice, but at a somewhat larger impurity here, this 8-side cluster that is designed in such a way that if we look at the structure of this in reciprocal space within DCA, we have one momentum patch here that takes care of the nodal part and one part that takes care of the antinodal part. And you can see your non-interacting Fermi surface passes exactly through these two sectors and to no other sectors. And even if you introduce a T prime that's weak or a bit stronger, this picture essentially does not change that much. If you then solve this problem within this dynamical mean field theory with a continuous time auxiliary field solver, what you see is that you find a momentum selective phase transition. So you find a phase in which one of the sectors has become insulating and the other sector stays metallic. So you see all of a sudden you have a metal here in this area, but an insulator in that area.
You apply some probe when you probe the system.
Yes. What does it? I just acoustically didn't understand.
What is the conclusion? The system is metallic.
Yes.
And there are some gaps
yes.
in some parts of mm-hmm. the Brillouin zone.
Exactly.
So
Fermi arcs.
Fermi arcs.
Experiment.
Differentiation between nodes and anti-nodes.
Okay. Well, finally, for a review on this, or just an explanation of all these various algorithms and where one can best apply them, there's my PhD thesis. I'm also going to upload this link to the wiki. There are open source codes for all these algorithms that will be published this summer as part of the ALPS library. And the important take-home message is that new algorithms don't just save you a lot of CPU power, they actually allow you access to new physics. So you can do larger systems, you can sometimes do the extrapolation to the infinite system, you can do general interactions, and you can do more orbitals. And with that, I would like to pass over to Philip.
All the non-experts in DMFT should feel free to ask questions.
If you get away from hot feelings,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of just usually finite mode approximation doesn't work so well.
Mm-hmm.
You don't experience the problem.
We have different problems away from half filling concerned with this sign problem that's been mentioned before. But everything is completely under control. Actually, if you dope a lot, you can see that all these cluster meshes completely converge and give you a result that is independent of the cluster that you're using.
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly.
The approximation of the self-energy
yes.
half-filling for the impurity problems usually works extremely well.
By accident, because the atomic limit is okay,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah, but as soon as you get away,
yes.
infinitesimally small.
Yes.
Doesn't.
That's right, but there is no a priori truncation of the perturbation series in any of these methods, right? There's no truncation. That's very important to realize, right? I mean, the Monte Carlo selects in all these diagrammatic Monte Carlo methods, the Monte Carlo selects which order you want to work at.
In order to some order to actually get the number you put in the cube.
No, you don't put an you don't put in the I should probably not talk, but
the final system methods only the Oh, that's that you have to contribute, so a few hundred, a few thousand, and not more. And the rest is suppressed. But if you know the template tree, you need more orders. The metric size is shown, what's this mean order that contributes.
So you use methods, you never tell the computer to consider the surge at all at 50.
The diagram C for the infinite system, you have to truncate. Yeah. 10 to order, 20 to order.
Yeah, but that's a different thing.
Yes. Here on the finite cluster, you don't have to truncate. Yeah.
Sorry for the slow start. So I will present some relatively recent application or extension of the methods which Emmanuel described, namely the treatment of pronouns or retarded interactions in single-site DMFT using these diagrammatic Monte Carlo methods. And the motivation is the following. The low energy properties of correlated electron systems are usually described by model Hamiltonians which capture the physics of the localized D or F electrons. And these Hamiltonians are ideally obtained by a systematic procedure in which the weakly correlated electrons in the system are integrated out. And as, for example, Miyake-san knows very well, this procedure generically leads to interaction parameters which have some frequency dependence because of the real or virtual transitions from these correlated D electrons into the discarded bands. And so here are some is a plot which I took from one of these papers, Arias et Avant's papers, which shows the frequency dependence of the Hubbard U for different compounds. And so, for example, for gadolinium, the find interaction U, which rises from a static value of about 6.5 to a value of about 16 in an energy window of about 2 electron volts. And similarly for cerium, they find a frequency dependent U which varies between about 4 and 8 in an energy window of about 5 eV. And so you can see that for at least certain materials, the frequency dependent U varies very substantially over a frequency range which is itself comparable to the interaction scale in the problem. And this, I think, raises interesting issues, namely how, on the physics side, how these frequency dependent interactions affect, say, the properties of the system, such as spectral functions, and so forth. And on the methodological side, of course, there is a challenge, or this poses a challenge. The question is, how can we simulate model systems with such frequency-dependent U?
Understand correctly, you take the band structure calculations at the different energies, and you find the effective Hamiltonian, which would then have a different U.
You define some orbitals which you want to describe, and you discard the rest, and then you have virtual or real transitions between these distinguished orbitals and the rest, and that gives you, I mean, the assumption is that the rest is relatively weakly correlated, so you can use some variant of the random phase approximation, for example, to compute the polarization function, and then you get the frequency-dependent polarization function, so forth. But that, I think, will be something which Yake-san will explain in great detail next week. So he's the expert on that. So my starting point is sort of an input of this kind, a frequency-dependent U of this kind, and then I'm wondering how we can simulate within a single-site DMFT a Hubbard model with such a frequency-dependent U. And this is actually a challenging problem, and I found this nice sentence in a paper by many of the people here in the audience, namely that they have basically a statement here that there is a systematic procedure to derive these frequency-dependent U's, but somehow in practice it's impossible to do a calculation with that. And I think the statement was correct in 2004. And why is it? Why was it impossible to do a calculation?
We didn't say impossible. We said difficult.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry for that. But let's briefly discuss what was the problem with previous methods. Namely, for example, Hirsch-Fey, as Emmanuel discussed, is based on a time discretization of the imaginary time interval, and these frequency-dependent interactions lead to retarded interactions in time, so you would have to decouple a very large number of interaction terms by auxiliary fields, and even the cubic scaling of the problem, this is just not in practice doable. And on the other hand, Hamiltonian-based methods such as exact diagonalization or whatever, NRG. In such a method, you would have to introduce many bosonic modes. You would have to couple many bosonic modes to the system in order to reproduce such a arbitrary frequency-dependent interaction. And the Hilbert space of that problem immediately exceeds what can be done numerically. So that, I think, was the idea behind this sentence. But what I now want to show is that with these new diagrammatic Monte Carlo methods, one can actually treat such frequency-dependent interactions very efficiently and in a very simple way. Okay, so Emmanuel has given a very nice introduction to this weak coupling and strong coupling diagrammatic Monte Carlo methods. So I can skip this part, and perhaps to fix the notation, now just briefly describe how we do a diagrammatic Monte Carlo simulation for a Hubbard model with the hybridization expansion. Then I will show how to extend this formalism to the case where we couple bosons to the model, and I will then show what is the frequency-dependent interaction for the Holstein-Hubbard model, and from there it's then a simple step to understand how to extend this formalism to arbitrary frequency dependent U. So, okay, for simplicity, I will consider a one-band Hubbard model whose Hamiltonian is given here. We have a local part describing the impurity with interaction chemical potential terms. I have a non-interacting bath and a hybridization term which describes exchange of electrons between impurity and the bath. The formalism which I will describe is not restricted to density-density interactions. It's applicable to arbitrary multi-orbital models with general interactions, but it's restricted to a single-site DMFT. It's not a cluster formalism. Okay, so the idea is, as Emmanuel explained, we expand the partition function now in this strong coupling algorithm in powers of these hybridization terms, and then we compute the trace over the impurity and the bath. And once we have expanded in the hybridization terms, the time evolution does no longer couple the impurity and the bath, and therefore we can trace out the bath degrees of freedom analytically, and what that gives us is a determinant of hybridization functions. That part we can do analytically, and what remains is we have to compute a trace over a sequence of such time evolution operators which are given by the local part of the Hamiltonian and creation and annihilation operators for the impurity. And this must still be computed explicitly, and in the simple situation where we have a density-density interaction, we can use the so-called segment picture where we separate spin-up operators from the spin-down operators, and we represent the time intervals in which electron of spin-up, say, sits on the impurity by a segment, a black segment like this. And then, using this segment representation, we can express this trace here, the contribution of the local Hamiltonian, in a very efficient way through these overlaps of up and down segments, which give us the interaction contribution to the weight and the length of the segments, which give the chemical potential contribution. So it's basically exponential of this type, where minus u times the length of the overlap is the interaction contribution, and mu times the length of the segments is chemical potential contribution. So that's an extremely efficient algorithm for single-site models with density-density interaction. And now let's look at how we can extend this formalism if we now couple bosons to this model. So we have basically the same Hamiltonian interaction chemical potential term, but now we also have dispersionless phonons with frequency omega zero, which couples via this Holstein coupling to the number of electrons on the dot. And we have the same bath and hybridization term, and the strategy is exactly the same as before. We expand now the partition function in powers of the hybridization term, and we take the trace over impurity, bath, and now also the phonon states. So once we have done the expansion in the hybridization, the impurity and the bath are decoupled, so we can again trace out the bath. That gives us, as before, the determinant of hybridization functions. But the difference now to the previous case is that this time evolution operator, which brings us from one creation or annihilation operator to the next, still has the phonons in it. So we have to compute here now the trace over the impurity and the phonon degrees of freedom. And so at first sight, this looks like a complicated problem. One could now go and do what one would do in Hamiltonian-based methods, namely express these creation and annihilation operators as operators in the big space, Hilbert space, which contains the phonon states, and that would then require multiplications of big matrices and be very expensive. And also, it would necessarily involve a truncation of the Hilbert space to very few phonon states. But what I will show now is that in fact the problem is much simpler, namely we can compute this trace over the phonon degrees of freedom analytically, and what that gives us in the end is just an additional factor in the weight which can be interpreted as an additional interaction between these segment endpoints, which is somehow defined by these phonon terms. And the other change which appears here is that, well, once we have computed the trace over the phonons, we end up with basically a model which is of the same form as the Hubbard model, but there are modifications in the parameters. So we have a shift in the interaction parameter and in the chemical potential parameter. So basically what appears here as an interaction parameter is now the screened interaction, which is reduced by the phonon coupling. And I will not really go into details, but here's a very quick summary of how one proceeds to integrate out the phonons. The idea is to decouple the electrons and the phonons by so-called Lang-Virchow transformation. We write here the phonon operators in terms of these X and P operators, and then we use this unitary transformation e to the I P X 0 to shift the X coordinate, the X operator, by some distance X 0, and if we choose this X 0 in an appropriate way, we can completely decouple the electrons from the phonons, so that the transformed Hamiltonian is now simply a Hubbard-like Hamiltonian plus the phonons, but no coupling between electrons and phonons anymore. So what you can see here is these are triggers on top of the U and the mu. What this means is that these are now modified interactions and chemical potentials. So due to the coupling to the phonon, we have a reduction in the interaction and also a shift in the chemical potential. And the second change which appears here is that these operators C and C dagger in the diagrams have now a phonon factor multiplied to it. But because the time evolution operator now does not couple the phonons and the electrons anymore, we can again separate these phonon factors from the electron creation and annihilation operators, and then compute the trace over these phonon factors analytically. And I will not go through this, so we have basically to evaluate an expression like this for non-interacting bosons, and that can be done. And the final expression is something like this, not a very complicated expression. So what you recognize here is a sum over all pairs of operators of an interaction sort of in the form of a cosine hyperbolic function. And that's what I showed in one of the previous slides. That's sort of the simple interpretation of this formula. We have now one factor in the weight which is the Hubbard, identical to the Hubbard model but with shifted U and mu, plus a phonon factor which may be interpreted as an interaction between all pairs of operators in the diagram. And the form of this interaction is a cosine hyperbolic function. And the bottleneck in these calculations is always the handling of the hybridization determinants, how to update these determinants, and evaluating these few interaction lines here is very cheap compared to that. So what it means is that adding phonons to this problem basically doesn't change the efficiency of the method. You hardly feel the effect of the phonons if you do the simulation in this way. And so the simulation remains very efficient. And so let me just briefly show you the phase diagram now for a phonon problem where the frequency omega 0 is much smaller than the bandwidth. One obtains a phase diagram in the space of interaction, bare interaction U, and Kronon coupling strength lambda, which looks roughly like this. Here, given by the red lines, we identify three different phases: the metal at weak U, the MOST insulator at strong U, and small phonon coupling. And then at strong phonon coupling, one has a bipolaronic insulator, which is like a charge-ordered phase. Okay. Now let's see how we can extend this formalism to arbitrary screened interactions. In this case, now we have in our Monte Carlo weights interaction factor, which has here the instantaneous interaction U alpha or U, which I call U, plus a retarded interaction which I call W. So it's generically something of this form. And now if we use the segment representation for our diagrams, what we have to evaluate here for the non-local contribution to the weight is a double integral of the function W over these segments. And that is very easily done. We introduce a stem function, which I called here h. So that's a function whose second derivative gives w. And then we can just express this double integral over this pair of segments using this stem function evaluated at all pairs of endpoints here. And so in terms of this function h, as you can see, we now have something like an interaction between all the segment endpoints, and we are now back at exactly the same type of representation as we had before for the phonons. And so basically we can, using this analogy and the big formula which I showed before for the phonons, this formula here, we can immediately extract what is the retarded interaction for a Holstein-Hubbard model with phonon coupling lambda and phonon frequency omega. It's such a cosine hyperbolic function, and we can do the Fourier transformation and the analytic continuation, and we get the frequency-dependent interaction for the Holstein-Hubbard model, and that's a function which is shown here. So it basically has a plasmon pole here at frequency omega zero, and at high frequency it approaches the unscreened U, and at low frequency we have a screened U which is reduced by 2 lambda square over omega zero. Now here we have the real part. By Cramer's Kronig we get the imaginary part, which in this case is simply a delta function. And now if we compare this to a typical screened interaction as computed by Miyake-san or Ferdi, you see basically these features. You see in the imaginary part something like a broadened delta function, and in the real part something like such a pole. Now, if a delta function here gives such a cosine hyperbolic contribution to the non-local interaction, then a very general imaginary part gives simply such a superposition of cosine hyperbolic functions. So that is really the link between the input from Miyake-san and the algorithm which I described before for the phonons. We take the imaginary part of the screened interaction, we plug it into this formula. That gives us sort of the interaction between the endpoints of the segments in these segment diagrams, and then we can more or less use the Holstein-Hubbard formalism to simulate this. And that's just as efficient as the Holstein-Hubbard model. You barely feel the effect of the retardation.
Just one technical question. I mean, can you go back to the previous slide? So So in the typical material, of course, the difference between the screen U and the high frequency value and screen value U is typically very large, right? I mean, here we can see that it's like 15, 17 EV at high frequency.
That's the 203, yes.
EV at low frequency. So is this difference between U infinity and U zero making the numerical calculation harder, or does the algorithm work fine even if that difference is very big?
Yeah, it works everywhere. I didn't notice any numerical problems.
And that is because again, it's an expansion around it's the strong coupling expansion. If we were doing the whoop subversion, then we would have a problem, probably.
That's right. Yes. I mean, I have studied the dependence of the average perturbation order on phonon coupling strength for the Holstein-Hubbard model. It's very weak. So one should go back here and see how the perturbation order depends on
this. In practice, this is what we need.
The difference is 19.
Yeah, 2 lambda, of course.
So I would expect a very small effect. Mm-hmm. And if at all, then a large U should probably help. Usually perturbation order gets smaller. I will show you some simple model calculations, and I didn't have any difficulties in the situation where there is a very large unscreened U.
Right.
Okay, so here are these model calculations. I will show basically Holstein-Hubbard-like models now, but with frequency omega zero, this time of the same order of magnitude as the bandwidth, not much smaller as in the phonon case, but relatively large frequencies. So that's basically consistent with the features you see in these screened interactions. And then you obtain phase diagrams in the space of U and screening strength, which look a little bit different. You have now a metallic phase which extends very far into the large U regime. So in a point, if you sit here somewhere in this metallic phase, you have an unscreened U which is very large, but due to the reduction of the static interaction, you are still metallic. And so,
sorry, you said before this, by the Ronald Kinselevs, it was charge ordered.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that in the
single side? Yeah, that's a little bit indirect, I would say. What you see is that the solution, as you cross this line, suddenly starts to oscillate between empty and full. So these are calculations at half filling. And so the charge order state would be half the sites doubly occupied, half the sites empty, and then you suddenly see an oscillation.
And so you really see it between those two. You see it's like a complete charge order. It's not just a...
Yeah. It's basically complete. Yeah, as soon as you cross this line.
Maybe I can elaborate further on that. There's no problem, even in the single cell theory, to simulate the charge order phase. You just have to extend the mean field equations to the two-cell lattice structure and run your simulation there.
Right? No, that's right.
Plus minus.
Yeah, probably that's the case in Wisconsin.
So here's a plot somewhat related to your question about the ratio between unscreened and screened interaction. So here's a phase diagram now for different position of this pole. You have here the screened interaction, here the UC2 for this temperature, beta 50, is about 5.1, and now you see the effect of screening. And typical materials, at least if you look here, have maybe a ratio of U to U screened of 2 or 3, so we are somewhere in this region. And you can see that now for a frequency omega of the order of the bandwidth, which is 4 in this case, you have
quite a substantial effect still on the UC2. And even for models with frequency much, much larger than the bandwidth, so factor of 5 larger than the bandwidth, you still have a noticeable reduction in the screened interaction, in the critical interaction for photometal insulator transition. So
here I can read this phase diagram like I fixed the screened value of U, low frequency one, for given omega zero, say, and then I increase the high frequency value, right?
Yes.
And see how I can reach the mod state with the same screened value of U just by
right.
The high
frequency. Or you can read it as follows, you sort of fix the position of this pole.
Yeah.
And then you ask yourself, at which value of the screened interaction do I get the metal insulator transition? Mm-hmm. And what you learn from this is that even a pole at very high frequency still has a non-negligible effect on the critical value of the screens of the static interaction here, which you need to drive the metal insulator transition. And here is a plot of a spectral function. So now the question is, how does this more complicated frequency-dependent interaction manifest itself in the spectral function as we approach the metal insulator transition? So in this case, I choose an omega of 3 and a bare interaction of 10, so quite a bit above UC2. And I change the screened interaction. And then I look what the spectral function does. So for relatively a weak phonon coupling or weak screening, I have an insulating solution with a gap. But it's not the insulating solution which you are familiar with from the static interaction, which has just one hump near U over 2. You see you have one very broad hump roughly near U over 2, which is 5, plus a prominent hump near the gap edge. And then as you decrease the screened interaction, as you approach the metal insulator transition, this gap edge feature becomes much sharper, and eventually you see a metal insulator transition, the appearance of a quasi-particle peak, but the metallic phase still has these very prominent side peaks, basically roughly at the position corresponding to the screened U, plus remnants of the Hubbard bands at the unscreened U. So you see these two features in the spectral function. And here is now a plot where I fix the screened interaction at 3 and the unscreened interaction at 8, and I shift the frequency of the plasmon pole. And here you see how this affects the spectral functions. You now see that at least in the metallic phase, these low energy peaks are more or less, I mean, not constant, but they shift much less dramatically than the phonon frequency. If I increase it from, say, 2 to 16 by a factor of 8, this shifts perhaps by a factor of 2. And so this sort of supports the interpretation that these sidebands are the screened U Hubbard bands, or roughly, because that's the quantity which is kept fixed in this plot. So we have here a low energy peak, which is roughly a screened U Hubbard band. However, if you look more carefully, you will find that the peak of these sidebands is not at half the value of the screened U, but about 60% of that value. So I think that's one of the lessons from this study, namely the fact that you cannot reliably extract from the features in these spectra the values of the screened or the unscreened Hubbard U. Because you have this screened U Hubbard band, which is only about at 60% of the screened U, and you have a
sort of second Hubbard band, which is depending on plasmon frequency far above the unscreened U Hubbard band, which would be here.
But this result somehow invalidates lots of results what has been doing in, has been done in past years.
In practice, yeah, that's right. I mean, common practice has been to extract the U for model calculation, say, from photoemission data, from features in photoemission data. And this sort of, yeah.
And also, I mean, what you take, let's say, if in combination with ab initio tools, with dynamical mean field theory, we take as an input this low frequency result,
mm-hmm.
and also this what you showed a few slides before.
Yeah, you neglect basically the pole at very high.
The high frequency interaction influences the results importantly.
That's sort of a conclusion. So, yeah, what I think the common practice would have been up to now to say in such a situation, well, we just have static U, which is the screened U, because the pole is at very high frequency.
I guess, Philip, what I'd like to know is, imagine we consider a situation which is sort of generic for Gaussian material, namely the screen mm-hmm. U. Let's simplify things. The screen U is a few eV. The plasmon is at, I don't know, 15 eV or something like this. And then it jumps to high frequency value of U unscreened, which is, let's say, 20 eV.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I take those parameters, right, and I look at the spectral function, then what am I going to get? Where are the features?
Well,
the bandwidth, I mean, the, of course, I should also specify what the bandwidth is. The mm-hmm. bandwidth is a few EVs too, mm-hmm. right, for the low energy.
Well, of course, you see that as you push the pole to four times bandwidth.
That's right, which in practice is...
You sort of start to approach. So it's not very well visible here, but there's a dashed line,
okay.
which is the spectral function for the static model with screen U. And you see, okay, the peak position starts to approach this.
Yes.
But if you compare the weight of the quasi-particle peak, for example, you see that a substantial weight is still shifted to higher energies. There's still a feature here.
Of course,
there is. Maybe it's a bit unphysical to have a complete pole here.
There's something like omega zero, which is not as big, and so lose some weight.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really omega zero. I mean, here it appears to be omega zero, but if you push it to even
2 and 16, I get more or less 18, where your broad peak is.
Hmm. But I tried also much even larger, like 30, and it wouldn't. But perhaps the Mach-Zehnder procedure eventually fails.
From these results, it is, just to elaborate on what Yanni was saying, it is correct to say that if the plasmon pole is at high frequency, then we are not making that big a mistake extracting the value of the screen U by the difference between the low and the upper band that would be measured in photoemission. There has to be some
eventually it converges to that, yes, that's right.
Okay.
But my point was that over surprisingly, over a considerable region of frequencies, you have a regime in which you cannot...
We actually noticed such things before, so in simplified solvers, my student Serge.
For example, in this situation here...
It's not that bad, you want to say.
It depends on the actual values, but in the real material, mm-hmm. most of the time we have, as I said, we have a bandwidth of a few eV, we have a U screened of a few eV, we have a plasmon, at 15 eV, right? And we have an unscreened which is 20, 25 eV. So yes, I think the generic situation is not that bad. Otherwise, there is like, you know, 30 years of sort of empirical knowledge from photoemission that sort of collapses abruptly, which cannot be completely proven.
Before we throw all this away, we'd like to see what comes out of these calculations regarding other physical properties.
No, but this is very important, of course.
So just as a last slide, one similar calculation of a different type of model, namely linear frequency dependence of the imaginary part. I think when I looked at the results for nickel, it had a essentially linear imaginary part up to very high frequencies. So I was interested what does this model give us. And yeah, basically qualitatively very similar behavior, except that now the distinction between screened U and unscreened U half bands is less clear. And yeah, instead of a unscreened U half band, one just gets a very broad tail in the spectral function. Okay, but otherwise qualitatively same behavior, also a substantial shift of spectral weight from the quasi-particle peak to high energy shoulders. Okay, and that's basically what I wanted to present here. So I explained how we can efficiently do a hybridization expansion for Holstein-Hubbard model and how to extend this formalism to arbitrary frequency-dependent interaction. So we have now a formalism which can directly take the imaginary part of omega computed by Miyake-san, plug it into the program, and get, do the simulation with basically no additional computational cost. And I showed you some results for the metal insulator transition in a situation where U is, the bare U is substantially larger than UC2 and omega is of the order of the bandwidth. And now the outlook is that we have a formalism which can be applied to real materials. We can now do fully self-consistent GW plus DMFT calculations, extended DMFT, and so forth. And okay, with that I would like to stop.
Questions, comments, topics for discussions? Well, maybe I can make a little sort of wrap up on this last part. It's very clear that in any concrete correlated material, the only way to give a proper definition of U is actually by considering the full frequency dependence. In fact, in that, if you view things like that, you can view U of omega as really a very precise concept, which is the what we need to put to represent the actual screen interaction from a local point of view. So it gives the concept of a U for a correlated material a unique and an ambiguous definition, which is essentially impossible to formulate precisely if you just limit yourself to a static U. So I think, you know, having a real, real good numerical methods to treat these frequency-dependent interactions is important for the next steps in realistic electronic structure calculations of correlated systems. This is pushing the field further.
I think a good comment as well. There's an interesting class of organic materials which show a lot of them are MOS insulators, and you tune the chemistry a little bit and you see a charge ordered state. They're all at half filling, so this looks very reminiscent of your phase diagram. So it'd be interesting.
So you're thinking about the BDTs?
No, about the palladium DMAT materials.
Okay.
So they're quite similar to the BDTs.
Be careful, I'm going to ask you to talk about it. If you continue on that line.
I think they're really exciting cross materials, and there's been essentially no theory on them at all. And really only one group that's done experiments.
Okay.
They show
which group is that?
Katsu's group in Rika.
Nice. Of course, Japanese.
Yeah, and there's probably a spin liquid there. There's a charge ordered state. There's all kinds of cool stuff in there.
Thank you.
More? have a question to your last comment.
The question should be addressed to the speaker.
Yeah, sorry. Or maybe I can say, like, where does, so the energy dependence of the U, it comes, as you said, from the screening, basically by the conduction electrons, right? And if the, but if the conduction electron density of states is basically flat, then you wouldn't expect an energy dependence, right, of the U by that reasoning, or
why not? What's
the, you have
transitions between the correlated states and the uncorrelated ones.
I mean, yes. If you go to very, very high energy, right, yes, all the screening processes are totally inefficient.
Yeah, of course.
And U is just the matrix element of
right. No, but I mean low energies, basically.
If you go to low energy, screening is efficient.
Yes.
And then so.
Yeah, I mean, screening is efficient, but is it also very energy dependent, or?
Oh, yeah, no, but I guess, you know, we've seen.
I mean, if you have a really flat S for.
I understand what you are saying. I guess we see more curves along those lines from Takashi's talk probably next week. But there are any of these, maybe you can show again one of these strontium BO3 curves or whatever. Yeah, so this has lots of wiggles and terms and so on. Okay, these to me are like second order issues. I mean, the main issues, which is what Philip emphasized, right, is that it's that large, it's mm-hmm. you know, damn large at high frequency,
yeah.
Then there is a plasmon pole,
yes,
and it's small.
That's the main feature.
That's the main feature. Yeah. That's what we want to deal with first.
Okay,
then we can discuss the wiggle, and the ups and downs, the fact that between, you know, 0 and 10 eV, it actually varies from 3 to 2, I mean, that will have some minor influence.
And this pole is actually a general property of any material, probably,
sure,
right?
Yes, so absolutely. This is always there.
Okay, no.
Okay, more questions, comments on any of the three topics?
I just wanted to, so this is computational aspect. This is not limited to a single orbital. It's just
no.
You need to have no k dependence on in.
Good question.
No, this method is limited to single site, but not to single orbital, because the phonons will couple to the total density on the site. But yeah, as soon as you want to go to cluster, this, it will not be possible to integrate out the phonons in this way. And then I think the weak coupling approach of Assad would be the way to go.
More questions? Okay, I think we should thank warmly the three speakers.